Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Catherine Iden, in for Sean Corcoran. And this is our weekly news roundup, where we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Cindy McCormick, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Good morning, Cindy. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And joining us a little later will be Ryan Bray from the Falmouth Enterprise, Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Jim DeRuda of the Standard Times will bring us news from the South Coast. And we'll also hear from Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette and Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. And we'll check in with Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. But first, let's take a look at some of the news here on the Cape and Islands with you, Cindy McCormick. It was a big week for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. They revealed some plans for their casino in Taunton. So what can future visitors expect to see from the site?
The casino is called the First Light Casino and Resort, and it is being billed as a resort. And it's going to have, it's going to be a casino with a 300-room hotel with twin towers. There'll be a gaming floor with 3,000 slot machines, 150 game tables, and 40 poker tables. But eventually, there'll also be a water park and a spa, variety of restaurants, food court, steakhouse. It's going to be built in phases, and they hope to open the first phase by the summer of 2017.
That's right. And they're billing this as like an integrated casino and resort. And they're hoping to get people who won't just come for the slot machines and the table games, but who will actually come for entertainment and to shop and to even stay for the weekend. And that's why they have such a wide variety of things, I think, that they're offering, right?
That's right. Yeah, they're definitely billing it as a resort and, you know, and a destination for basically the family.
You're right. And another piece of news, not just about what they're going to be doing as far as what they're building, is that they're going to be working with one of the biggest casino operators in the world. And they announced that at the a meeting with the State Gaming Commission this week. They had two big announcements. One was Monday, and then the next one was this hearing with the Gaming Commission, where I really think they tried to kind of make their pitch as to why it's important that there just be one casino in this region. And so tell us about that a little bit.
Well, for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, the road to the casino has been very long, and now there's been, you know, another obstacle. You know, they finally got their federal recognition. They're going ahead with plans to build this casino. As a matter of fact, they hope to break ground next month on the casino. But now it turns out that the Massachusetts Gaming Commission is considering whether to license a commercial casino, right nearby in Brockton, and that would actually, you know, put a big, you know, crimp on plans and or possible competition levels. And also, it would deduct some of the revenue. Under the terms of the agreement with the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and the state would get 17% of the total gambling revenues, the gross gambling revenues from the casino, which is estimated to be about $28 million a year. Now, the state wouldn't receive a dime of that if the commercial casino went forward in Brockton, which is considered the Southeast Region, Region C. So there's, under the terms of the agreement, there's supposed to be no competition. And Cedric Cromwell, the tribal chairman, had strong words for the Gaming Commission. He accused them of threatening to single-handedly destroy the gaming landscape in Massachusetts when tribal members met with the commission members Tuesday in Mashpee.
Mm. And the commission will be meeting later this month for another hearing to look at that Brockton casino, so we'll be following that.
Yeah, March 28th will be their next meeting.
And we're going to turn now to some news from Falmouth. And on the line with us is Ryan Bray of the Falmouth Enterprise. Good morning, Ryan. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. So the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, known as NOAA, is thinking of moving its fishery center out of Woods Hole. And they haven't said exactly where they want to move it to yet, but New Bedford officials are trying to get their attention. So tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a developing story. So back in December, news filtered out that NOAA was at least considering exploring their options for the current facility, which has been on Water Street since 1961. NOAA officials are of the mind that it may be time for relocation. They need a bigger facility to bring all of the fishery center's operations under one roof. No decision's been made yet, but city officials in New Bedford have in writing expressed their desire, their interest in bringing the fisheries to the New Bedford waterfront if and when NOAA officials do decide to make a move. They basically have cited, you know, a lack of communication, some ill will between the science community and the fishermen, local fishermen over the past 20 years or so, and they're saying that bringing the sides closer together in a physical sense. You know, bringing the fishery center to New Bedford would bring that into closer proximity to one another. In that way, they can open up a better dialogue and sort of mend fences, so to speak.
Right. And the scientists down here in Woods Hole and organizations here haven't been that thrilled with the idea that the center might move away, correct?
No, not at all. In addition to selectmen, representatives from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute and the Marine Biological Laboratory, HUI and MBL, have also kind of, you know, expressed their strong support for keeping the fisheries where it is. You know, losing that fisheries, it would have a lot of implications for the science community and Woods Hole, and they really don't want to see it go away. Basically, all three arms work together. They have a very cooperative and collaborative relationship. So I think there's concern about, you know, the economic impact of losing the fisheries, and from a research standpoint, the domino effect that losing the fisheries from Woods Hole could have just for the science community at large and local businesses and everything. It's just a risk I think they don't want to take.
Any word on when NOAA may make a decision as to if they'll move this center?
No officials have said they're on a timetable to come to some sort of decision whether or not to move it this spring. They have not made a decision as of yet, but as far as we understand, they're still holding that timetable, so something could be imminent.
Well, thanks so much for that update, Ryan. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Kathy.
And with me in studio is reporter Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. And we have another Mashpee story that came out this week, and we've been following for many months now. School committee in Mashpee met to discuss how they'll pay the remainder of former Superintendent Brian Hyde's contract, and that's more than $400,000.
Yeah, it's exactly $425,000. Now, the business administrator, Paul Funk, said that the school will have that the buyout will have no impact on any of the schools. The agreement was signed with the school chairman, John Myers, March 3rd. And according to those terms, Hyde will receive $210,000 by April 1st and the balance of $215,000 no later than July 30th. Mm-hmm. Which is the next fiscal year.
Mm-hmm. And now they're saying that they have the money for this year, but there's, I think, a little bit less certainty for the next fiscal year. And the years change over in June. It's not with the calendar year.
Right, right. And so for the end of this fiscal year, they plan on using unused grants and also replacing higher paid employees who have moved to new jobs in district with staff at lower pay. Next year, they're a little bit less certain, but they're confident it can be done. And one of the ideas is to hold off on hiring a new superintendent. Assistant Superintendent Patricia DeBoer has been acting superintendent since Hyde went on paid leave in November. And school committee member Chris Santo says keep her on through the end of the school year without an assistant, and that will help save money that could be used to pay for Hyde's replacement.
Right. And now Hyde parted ways with the school district just recently, and it's following a controversy. So for those who may not remember, fill us in a little bit on what happened to lead us to Hyde's resignation.
Okay. Well, the move was considered an amicable parting of the ways, and the decision was announced early on February 26th after a closed-door, four-and-a-half-hour school committee meeting. But and it came a week after the judge ordered the Falmouth District Court to acquit Hyde of trespass and breaking and entering charges in connection with a September 29th visit to a student home. That was breaking and entering with intent to commit trespass. Resident Marilyn King said Hyde walked into her house uninvited to check out the residency status of her teenage daughter, who was at Mashpee High School trying to re-enroll after several months in Florida. Hyde admitted to entering the home, but said that he was invited in.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so that followed with quite a bit of controversy in the town over the way the school board handled things, and especially with the release of their own investigation, and I think kind of just led up to this.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy involved in this that went on for months. And now Hyde's separation agreement represents a salary he would have earned through the end of his contract, which is June 30th, 2018, plus unused sick and vacation time.
That's right. And he's going to be on paid administrative leave through the end of the year as well, so he can have health insurance benefits, right?
Correct.
Yes,
correct.
That's right. And we have on the phone Martha's Vineyard Gazette news editor Sarah Brown. Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Hi, of course. Thanks.
And in your news this week, a Lyme disease treatment bill is working its way through the State House, and you think it has some significant benefits or impact for the vineyard. So tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, definitely. Lyme disease is something that is obviously a big concern in all of Massachusetts, which has one of the highest rates of Lyme in the country, and especially on the Cape and Islands. Chilmark has the highest reported rates of Lyme in the state, followed by Nantucket, and most of the other vineyard towns and several towns in the Cape are right up at the top of the list. But this bill is aimed more at chronic Lyme disease, so Lyme disease that maybe doesn't respond to treatment right away, or where, you know, symptoms continue for sometimes years, and it's kind of a point of a lot of controversy in the medical community about how best to treat it. But this bill is aimed at, is mandates that insurance companies would be required to cover long-term treatment of Lyme disease if that is what's recommended by a doctor. And the Joint Committee on Financial Services this week approved the bill, so it'll now work its way through the House and Senate. You know, the Cape and Island legislators, Dan Wolf and Tim Madden, have said that they support the bill, which basically would just say that the doctors that do recommend a course of treatment for, like, antibiotics, or the usual treatment is antibiotics, for a long time, that insurance companies would be required to cover it. And some people say this allows doctors and not insurers to dictate care. There is some opposition from the Massachusetts Association of Healthcare Plans, who have said that it is a disadvantage for small businesses that are forced to offer this new benefit, you know, that it'll hurt small businesses that way with the increased costs, and also that there's a lack of medical evidence. But otherwise, the proponents of the bill said there's a lot of support, and there's a really, like I said, a way to let the medical community decide whether or not, you know, the best course of treatment for this chronic Lyme.
Right. And of course, we hear about news of this bill as we are warming up, and spring is on Sunday. And Lyme, of course, is a big concern every year here on the Cape. So it'll be interesting
Definitely,
to see how
that
goes.
Definitely. Yeah, the ticks are starting to be more active this time of year.
So yes, they are.
On everyone's mind. Yeah.
Right. And that's one of many bills that was brought out of committee on Beacon Hill this week as part of a deadline that a lot of legislators had to reach. And you also are looking at treatment options for opioid addiction on the island as part of a series.
Yeah, we've been taking a look. Obviously, you know, heroin use is also something that's really on, I think, nationwide is on a lot of people's minds, and it's becoming a big topic of conversation and concern here on the Vineyard, too, and kind of trying to take stock of what's going on here and also what are the treatment options. And there's been a lot of meetings in the past few weeks about how different communities can work together. This week, also up on Beacon Hill, Governor Charlie Baker signed a new bill into law that's a pretty comprehensive opioid bill with, you know, new ways to treat addicts and educate people about risks and prevent people from becoming addicted. So on the Vineyard, people said this is a really positive step forward to, you know, curb the increasing opioid addiction. But there's, you know, obviously a hurdle here, too, of what a lot of people point to is a lack of detox facility on the island, and that a lot of people are saying that's something that is urgently needed, that I guess there have been studies done that say that our numbers here on the Vineyard don't meet the requirements for a detox facility, but a lot of people say that they feel that that's not true, that the island would benefit, and certainly people struggling with addiction would benefit, that it's hard to, sometimes that's a big barrier of getting off the island, of finding someone to bed off island. So that's one thing that was pointed to, but we also did take a look at what is available, and there are there's a lot of intensive outpatient counseling available on the Vineyard. There are a lot of support groups, even for families of people battling addiction, that they can seek help. There's a sober living community, so that's really part of an ongoing process in Ireland to really evaluate what's available here and what needs to be done. And certainly the state law, which has, you know, certainly a key in all of that, too.
That's right. Certainly a lot going on, a very complicated issue, and, of course, an issue that really reaches all of us, is even though there are those kind of special challenges there on the island. Well, thank you, Sarah Brown.
Thank you.
For talking with us of the Martha's Vineyard
Gazette. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye now. And we're going to head to a break right now, where you're listening to The Point News Roundup. I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Sean Corcoran. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point, where we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Sean Corcoran. And with me in our Woods Hole studio is Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. And Cindy, a special research ship said goodbye to the region this week and headed off to Mexico.
And this is the NOR, and this is a 275-foot research vessel, that has been operated by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution for the U.S. Navy since 1970. It's done a lot of important research, and some that are most familiar to the public are the 1985 discovery of the wreck of the Titanic by a team of American and French scientists, and the 1977 discovery of life at undersea thermal vents in the Galapagos Rift off the west coast of South America.
That's right. So this is a ship that, and it sailed more than a million miles. And I have to admit that, full disclosure, I have a personal connection to the ship. My father and my brother sailed on it, and I did as well. And so watching it depart, although it's off to new and great things, was a little bittersweet for us.
We'll definitely be docked in a different sort of home port. It'll be Manzanillo on the west coast of Mexico. And it even has a new name. The new name, which I'm not sure I can pronounce, is Rio Tecolutla. Thank you. Say that again. Rio
Tecolutla.
Thank you.
That's
okay.
Right.
And it will be the largest of five research vessels in the Mexican Navy. Now, the Mexican government got it for free, but the government paid $3.3 million to outfit the vessel and receive training in running the ship. Dozens of Mexican Navy personnel have spent a month on the ship when it was docked and during a one-week cruise, getting to learn the ship from Hui personnel.
That's right. And Hui still has the ship RV Atlantis, which is home to the submarine Alvin. And it will be getting a new research ship, which is named the RV Neil Armstrong. And I know that's off the coast, the East Coast right now, checking its science gear, but we'll be seeing that later this spring. So that'll be exciting.
That'll be good to see it docked here again.
And joining us on the phone right now is Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks for joining us, Jim. Good morning.
Hi, Catherine.
Summer is returning, and that means so will sharks. And researchers want more monitoring buoys to see exactly what the sharks are doing. Is that right?
Indeed. Recently, they released some data from monitoring buoys deployed around the Outer Cape from this past summer and in Cape Cod Bay. And not surprisingly, they show that sharks tagged by Dr. Greg Scomel from the State Division of Marine Fisheries and other scientists. Most often, the sharks were detected on buoys off of Chatham and Orleans. Some 28 different sharks pinged more than 14,000 times off of Chatham last summer. A bit of a surprise was in Wellfleet, where buoys in Wellfleet Bay, or Cape Cod Bay near Wellfleet, detected five white sharks about 6,500 times. Now, Scomel says he's planning to widen the reach of these monitoring buoys, and specifically he wants to get more of them in Nantucket Sound. We've had limited evidence of great white sharks in Nantucket Sound in the past few years. In 2013, Catherine, who was tagged off of Chatham by O-Search, spent some time there, and in this past September, a dead white shark washed ashore on a West Harwich beach. And a couple of receiver buoys in Vineyard Sound, which were placed to detect tagged striped bass, also detected two white sharks. The buoys work on the same frequency, so they can detect both species. But the network of buoys in Nantucket Sound doesn't really provide enough coverage to get a really good picture of what's going on there as far as the sharks are concerned. So Dr. Scomel is hoping to place several more acoustic buoys in that vicinity this summer, and he's particularly interested in getting one or two in the area about 2 miles off Harwich, where an artificial reef is being built. The reef is expected to attract more fish to that area. More fish probably means more seals. More seals probably means more sharks. So he's working with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy to find sponsors and funding for these buoys. They cost about $2,200 each. And, of course, these are buoys that don't detect sharks in real time. Researchers have to manually download the data. But also this summer, they're going to be putting out a prototype real-time detection buoy off of Nauset Beach in Orleans, which is another one of the hotspots here, which will immediately notify officials if a tagged shark swims by. And, of course, we're only talking about sharks that have been tagged with these acoustic tags. Right now there's about 80 great white sharks that Dr. Scomel and others have tagged off of Cape Waters. Dr. Scomel says that's probably just a fraction of the number that are swimming around off here in the summer. So once they start their annual shark population study again, probably in July, we'll be monitoring that to see what they come up with this year.
And it just goes to show you that scientists have so much more to learn about this species and their behavioral patterns. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of data comes in. And briefly, keeping with the wildlife theme, bird enthusiasts may soon be able to watch terns on the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge. We just have a minute.
Sure, indeed. Well, every summer about 8,000 pairs of terns nest on Monomoy. The Friends of Monomoy group recently got a grant, about a $9,000 grant, to set up a video camera out in the tern colony, which is closed to the public during the summer. So very few people other than the staff out there see these, the press, we've been out there a few times. You see these, 16,000 birds flocking around. It's an amazing sight. Hopefully this summer they'll be able to set this system up where they'll have a video camera right in the colony. They'll have a monitor at the visitor center on Morris Island. And ultimately, the goal is to stream this video on the web live. They're not sure if they can do that this year, but ultimately they'll hope to get that up within the next couple of years.
Well, that's good news for birders for sure. Well, thanks so much for talking with us, Tim. Have a great weekend.
You too, Catherine. Thanks.
And joining us now is Josh Balling, editor of the Nantucket Enquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
And opioid overdoses are on the rise on the island. And you talk about this in the wake of Governor Charlie Baker's bill that he signed this week to try to prevent some of these overdoses.
Right. And passage of that bill, which takes particular aim at prescription painkillers, does come at a time when at least four island residents have overdosed on heroin in the last month, including two at the same address within 2 days of each other last weekend. Each of those overdose victims was fortunately revived with the use of Narcan, the medication that temporarily blocks the effects of opioids. Nantucket, obviously not immune from this opioid and heroin epidemic that seems to be sweeping New England. Heroin overdoses on the island have been on the rise over the past several years, with more than a dozen reported last year as well. Police Chief Bill Pittman, the police department on the front lines of this, as are the fire department and the medical community, he spoke favorably of the bill, which places a 7-day limit on first-time opioid prescriptions and includes new efforts to evaluate and counsel patients within 24 hours of an overdose. He says that he believes that opioid addiction often starts with a legitimate drug that someone takes for a legitimate reason, medically prescribed to help them deal with a problem like pain. But then their dependence grows, the addiction grows stronger, and they have to find another place to continue to try and alleviate that pain, and they turn often to heroin, which is cheaper and sadly easier to get than prescription painkillers for a time. Nantucket Dr. Tim Leprey, who runs a program to help those addicted to opiates on the island, also praised the bill, but he said it could probably go a little bit further. He believes that as the pills become more expensive, heroin becomes more reasonable to purchase. He also says that 24-hour counseling is effective and reasonable, but the problem in his experience is that most patients with overdoses get treated with Narcan, leave, and they usually do so against medical advice. He'd actually prefer to see a longer period, perhaps, to be held, and that was something that was in the bill that got taken out. Nantucket, unfortunately, also has another challenge, another hurdle that some other communities don't have, and that there's no treatment facilities on the island right now. So patients have to leave the island, go to the mainland to seek help when they want it.
And definitely, as we just talked about with Sarah, too, from the Vineyard, that these are challenges for everybody, but the islands definitely have some extra added obstacles that have to be dealt with in working with this crisis. Also in the news there on the island, rescuers responded to a stranded common dolphin this week.
They did. A little bit of excitement yesterday afternoon. A short-beak common dolphin stranded itself on a mudflat in Pulpus Harbor, and he was helped to deeper water by some local officials, law enforcement, environmental police, and some volunteers on Thursday afternoon. The officials helped the dolphin out to deeper water. Not known exactly what its fate was. It was apparently sick when it was found, Nantucket Police Officer, Animal Control Officer Suzanne Gale said. But that dolphin was helped out to sea. Hopefully a happy ending there. Town officials, the police department say, if you come across a stranded or an injured marine mammal, don't touch it. Call the non-emergency number at the police department, 508-228-1212, and let the professionals take care of it. Marine mammals are protected species, and especially if they're injured or sick, not something that the average person really should be taking care of or dealing with.
That's right. That's good advice there, Josh. Thanks so much for talking with us. That's Josh Balling of the Enquirer and Mirror. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too.
And with me in studio is Cape Cod Times reporter Cindy McCormick. Thanks for being here, Cindy. And also, let's take a look now. Pilgrim, of course, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant has been in the news many, many times over the past years and was in the news again this week for several things. One is that our State Senator Dan Wolf was down in Washington, D.C., talking with regulators about rules for decommissioning power plants. And Pilgrim's going to be decommissioned in 2019. So this is of special concern to our region.
Yeah, once nuclear power plants are decommissioned, the health and safety issues related to demolishing them and decontaminating them can last for decades. So Senator Wolf is definitely concerned about many issues associated with this, including the possibility of having 3,000 radioactive spent fuel rods and wet pools on the upper level of the reactor building. He wants them moved to dry cast as soon as possible, which is safer, considered safer and more stable. And he also wants to put money, $25 million a year into a special fund to decommit he wants Entergy to pay $25 million every year into a special decommissioning fund to make sure it has the money to keep the plant safe during the decommissioning process.
That's right. And he's concerned there because Entergy has about just under $900 million, I believe, in that fund. And Entergy officials are saying that that's enough and that complies with NRC regulations. But of course, Wolf is concerned because it can take many, many years to decontaminate sites.
Yeah, he estimates it'll cost about $1.4 million to decommission the whole site. $1.4 billion to decommission the site. And another thing is it could take up to 60 years because the NRC has a program called Safe Store that allows these nuclear owners to drag out the process for 60 years. And Entergy has indicated that it is interested in pursuing that angle. Entergy says that they, you know, do not want to have to pay into this fund, and they are opposed to the legislation. And this bill that would require them to pay into the fund has just been reported out of committee favorably, so it may end up on the Senate floor fairly soon.
That's right. And Wolf was saying, too, that there's a tight timeline to try to get this Senate into the House.
Right,
too.
Right. He wants to see this happen right by the summer. So. Right.
And Wolf was invited down to talk to the NRC, and the NRC streamed this online. So I watched it on Tuesday, and he was part of a panel of representatives from other states that have plants that are either closing or will close. And I thought it was interesting that one theme, aside from this $25 million decommissioning fund addition, was that they all want the NRC to require plants to put together community task force. And a big concern that we've been hearing about, too, has been that residents and even state and local governments don't necessarily feel like they have a voice when these plants decommission.
There's a big concern there. And Mary Lampert of Pilgrim Watch said that the industry and many NRC members are downplaying the risks. And she said they pretend that once the licensee turns off the key, the risk magically disappears. And they're concerned, and citizens are concerned, and our legislators are concerned about requests being made by the nuclear plant owners to during the decommissioning process to do such thing as eliminate 10-mile emergency planning zones, reduce liability insurance, and site security. And that's one of the things that Senator Wolf has also been adamant about, that security be a high level of security be maintained on the site.
Mm-hmm. And there's another bill, too, in talking about security and safety plans, evacuation plans, of which the CAPE is not part of a plan right now. And Representative Sarah Peek has a bill that was just put out of committee favorably as well, that would, if it was to be enacted, try to wrangle some emergency plans, at least out of the state's emergency management agency, to try to deal with this post-decommissioning so that they can ease the minds of residents a little bit, I think.
Right. Yeah, it's another big concern for residents of the Cape and Islands who would be headed toward the plant.
That's right. And in other news, we learned today that Cape Cod Hospital and Falmouth Hospital are going to be expanding their psychiatric services. And they have psychiatric services already in place for some patients, but they want to expand that base.
Well, one of the things that they just expanded is their consultant services within the hospitals. That's at Cape Cod Hospital and Falmouth Hospital. That's run by Cape Cod Healthcare. And they've had consultant services in the past at Cape Cod Hospital, but they've really expanded them. And what it is doing, it's breaking down the barrier between medical care and psychiatric or psychological care, because the hospitals are providing psychiatric nurse practitioners and a psychiatrist to consult with doctors when they are seeing patients, and it could be in the emergency department, it could be on the medical surgical floor, who's experiencing some psychological distress or would be likely to experience psychological distress, someone who's been traumatized in a car accident, someone who's been a burn victim of assault, even someone who's had a heart attack that can really bring people low. Or, for instance, they just found out that they're going to have to go on kidney dialysis 3 times a week. You know what I mean? This has been, you know, a major life change that they're struggling with. While they're still in the hospital, they can see the nurse practitioner. They could see the nurse practitioner or the psychiatrist, and also consult with the family and the whatever attending doctor is there, whether it's the hospitalist who works for the hospital or their specialist, and come up with a plan and work with the family to come up with a treatment plan if they would need one. It could be medication and psychotherapy combination, and they could start that in the hospital and then continue it in the community. And this is seen as a way to both, improve the psychological health of people in the community, sort of like, you know, address issues before they get out of control, and also to reduce hospital stays because people with comorbid conditions are more likely, comorbid conditions means more than one problem, health problem.
Thank you for explaining, yeah.
Right, and it could be a psychological issue, and they tend to have longer hospital stays.
Right, yeah. Sounds like a kind of a well-needed service that they're going to be adding to the hospitals here.
Yeah, and it's part of a plan where they will be expanding other psychiatric services, too, in the community. They're really taking a look of what's needed in the community.
Right, mind and body together. Well, let's turn now and get an update on South Coast news. Joining us on the phone is Jim DeRuta of the Standard Times. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Catherine.
And you're looking at an issue in New Bedford schools where parents have been complaining of problems with behavioral problems and discipline problems. And now school officials are starting to really kind of face what's going on here. So tell us more.
Yeah, that's right. Your listeners may remember that New Bedford is a level 4 school. It's underperforming. The whole district is under a turnaround plan. And there is a level 5 school. The state's very interested in seeing things work in New Bedford. For a couple of years, we've heard from teachers and parents and the union that there are behavioral issues and too much violence in the schools. And since the new superintendent's been there about 2.5 years, Pia Durkin, she's come in with a lot of strong systems to make sure the schools are safe and secure. It seems, though, that we can't really get at the answer of whether behavioral issues are worse or are they being reported more. And that information is not just being prevented from getting into the newspaper. It seems parents and teachers aren't getting that information either. So at a school committee meeting this week, the place was packed with standing room only, and there was really discernible outrage from parents. Now, the schools have been putting in numerous programs to make things work, and the superintendent's leadership and experience really show that there have been demonstrations of improvements in behavior, but nevertheless, when one pops out, if you don't get all the information about it, or if some of the information is being withheld, the parents are left to wonder only about, can my students come safely to this school? Dr. Durkin points out that the attendance rates are very high in all three middle schools, and through her experience, she says if a school's not safe, parents don't send the children to the schools. Nevertheless, it's raised to a point now where this parental outrage actually threatens to kind of turn the tide on some of the positive things that have been happening in the past 2.5 years.
Wow. Sounds like it's an emotional issue, and obviously there's trust kind of involved there, too, between parents and school officials.
Absolutely. And I mean, the schools they've put all the right things into place. They've put more behavioral specialists into the schools. They're using a national program that's kind of a triage of behavioral issues in the class. And they're put in a program called conduct cards, where every issue creates a little conduct card. And Dr. Durkin pointed out to me yesterday that in one school with about, 120 conduct cards for the month of February resulted in almost 200 actions, responses, so that, she can demonstrate that issues are being dealt with. Obviously, some things slip through the cracks, but
she's
demonstrating that things are being dealt with, and yet teachers were standing up at this meeting saying that they know of other colleagues who are leaving because they can't take it anymore. And
it's a very, very complicated complicated issue.
Fantastically complicated and so important to New Bedford's future.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking with us about it, and certainly a story that we'll be following with you and as it develops. Thanks so much for talking with us, Jim.
Thank you, Catherine.
And we have to take a break, but we'll be right back with the Point News Roundup in just a minute. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Catherine Ident in for Sean Corcoran. And with me in our Woods Hole studio is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. But before we get to more regional news, we're also joined by Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Catherine.
So there's a story about an agreement with a sculptor in town to create a bronze statue commemorating a fisherman, but it's hit a snag. So what happened?
Yes, there's been a severance or a breaking down of the relationship between the Provincetown Fishermen's Memorial Committee and local sculptor Romolo Del Deo, who had an agreement to create this memorial sculpture honoring the town's fishermen. This is a conflict that has been brewing now for a couple of years. 3 years ago, the Fishermen's Memorial Committee and several other town boards, including the selectmen, approved this plan for Del Deo to create a monumental sculpture that would honor the fishermen, as I say. And the history of this is, of course, the iconic symbol of Provincetown for a long time has been the Pilgrim Monument. And a lot of people in town have felt that there ought to be a similar kind of monument, memorial, honoring the fishermen, many of them, of course, of Portuguese descent, who really settled and created and maintained the town of Provincetown over many, many generations. Whereas, of course, the pilgrims were only in Provincetown for a couple of weeks back in the late fall in 1620. So Del Deo came up with this idea for a design, and it was approved back in 2013. But there's been a dispute over how much it should cost. And the memorial committee last week officially announced that they were capping the cost of the project at $150,000. And Del Deo says that that's not nearly enough, that he submitted a budget, he says, for $398,000 back in 2013, and that the cost has now risen to about $500,000. So there's been a breakdown, and Del Deo will no longer be the sculptor doing this memorial.
Wow, that's... Sounds like that was an emotional issue there, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yes, it will. At least some people in town say it might be a good thing, because Del Deo says he's going to go ahead and raise money and do his memorial, and the committee is going to put out a request for proposals to do their own, so maybe the town will end up with two fishermen's memorials.
Oh, wow. Wow. And just real briefly, a local scientist has found evidence that the box turtle likes the power lines, but might be finding some trouble there. So really briefly.
Yes, this is Dr. Ray Clark, a scientist who lives in Truro, has spent 3 years tracking the eastern box turtle with the theory that they are drawn to the open areas around the power lines. And he's found that, in fact, this is true. The female turtles are attracted to those open areas where they nest and lay their eggs, but he's worried that, among other things, the herbicides that the power company sprays in order to control weeds there might be actually hurting the turtles, and there's no clear conclusion on that, but it's something to worry about.
Right, and of course, as spring is arriving, and Eversource does spray on power lines around the state, so it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Well, thanks, Ed, so much for talking with us. Have a great day.
Same to you, Catherine. Thank you.
And turning back to regional news, we have Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times here in studio. And this week we learned that the wait list is pretty long for students who want to get into charter schools here on Cape Cod.
Well, state education officials released a report saying a whopping 34,000 students are on wait lists for charter schools. That includes 540 at Sturgis Public Charter School in Hyannis and 101 at the Cape Cod Lighthouse Charter School in Harwich. Now, critics of charter schools say that these numbers are exaggerated. They say they are using old wait lists and rolling them over. And even the Massachusetts Office of the State Auditor said that the numbers are overstated. And they said that they know that most schools are no longer rolling over their wait list, but maybe 25% still are, and they don't know which schools those are, so they don't really have a handle on how the numbers are overinflated.
And of course, this is an item of special concern because there's been a lot of talk about raising the cap on charter schools in the state. And there's been, you know, vocal sides both for and against that idea.
Citizens for Public Schools is the sort of an anti-charter school. They represent the district schools. Those are the schools that you would go to if you lived in a town. And they say that waitlist should not be used to lift the caps. And they say that a study by the pro-charter Boston Foundation showed that some students on the waitlist are, you know, won't go there. They're keeping their options open. They might go to the district school, private school, another type of school. But it's interesting because I talked to Sturgis Charter Public School Executive Director Eric Kaiser, and he said that now his actual numbers are actually on the waitlist are even higher than what the state said, because the state figures of 540 on the waitlist were based on October 1st enrollment. They just had a lottery last month for students to get places in their 9th and 10th grade classes and in the fall, and they said that number is now 612. So the waitlist is going up, even though they built a second campus about 4 years ago.
Right. I was just going to say that. They have this new campus, and I think they were hoping to kind of mitigate that a little bit and spread this out, but in fact, it's just helped increase interest in for students attending the school.
That's right, and it's been going up by about 100 students, so, you know, recently per year or so. It's so
and probably not going to stop. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to turn now to some more Martha's Vineyard news, and on the phone is Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Nelson.
Good morning to you.
And so on the island, there's talk of a new walk-in clinic that will be completed in the next few months.
Yes, Martha's Vineyard Hospital has been talking about having a walk-in clinic now for a while, and now it seems as though it will be a reality. They have a workman there, and Tim Walsh, the CEO of Martha's Vineyard Hospital, said he expects a walk-in clinic to be completed sometime in April and certainly open for business for the summer, which will be a great help to the hospital. One of the realities of medical care on Martha's Vineyard is that we go from about 17,000 people to close to 100,000 on any given day in the summertime. And for someone with a problem that walks into the ER, that can be very costly for the person walking in. And also, it takes time from more serious cases and that the doctors and nurses have to deal with in the ER. So the walk-in clinic will be an option for those people who may not have something that requires the attention that you get in the emergency room, but certainly it will be helpful. And one of the other issues is that even for people who live here and who have a primary care doctor, often if you have a problem, you wake up, you don't feel well, it's not that easy to just call up your primary care doctor and walk into the office. So the walk-in clinic will fill that gap as well.
Right. A big gap being filled there with those extra services, I'm sure, are very welcome.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, it often happens, particularly people who have kids, they might have an earache or that sort of thing. Well, they might have the flu, and again, you don't, as anyone knows who's ever gotten a bill from the ER, it can be pretty steep because you're not just paying for what the care you've received, you're paying basically to keep that place running 24/7, and that can be a steep bill.
That's right. And speaking of bills and money, a new county minimum wage policy might make it hard for the trustees of reservations to hire seasonal workers.
Yes, the Dukes County Commissioners in November voted a policy of requiring a $15 minimum wage to be paid to both anyone working for the county or their subcontractors. And that policy really didn't affect the county because the county employees already make that. But it does have an effect on the trustees of reservations. That's the state's largest private nonprofit conservation organization, the trustees, pretty well known on Martha's Vineyard and also on Nantucket. On Martha's Vineyard, they own or manage a number of wonderful properties, including most of the beachfront on Chappaquiddick. And a number of years ago, I believe it was 2006, they took over management of the county-owned Norton Point Beach, which was, quite frankly, a mess. There were stakes from old fencing, this sort of thing, and they really did quite a nice job managing it. And what they're saying is that if this county policy applies to them, it's going to cost them an additional $20,000 to manage that stretch of beach. They said a lot of their rangers and summer, people, including the folks who monitor shorebirds, paid $10, $11, $12 an hour. That in many cases they're retirees or just summer people who aren't necessarily looking to make a career of this. They're looking to make some extra money in the summer. So the trustees in the county are trying to work this out, and we'll see where it goes.
Definitely a story of unintended consequences.
Yes.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Nelson. Have a great weekend.
You're welcome. You too.
Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And in studio with me right now is reporter Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. And we have a new county administrator, and he's only been on the job for a little while, and he's already asking for a state audit.
Yeah, the new commissioner, John Jack Units, got the county commissioners to agree to have an audit of county assets, real estate leases, and other agreements. He says that the Office of the State Auditor could help determine if some county properties could be sold to generate income. The audit comes as county officials grapple with the budget crisis and possible layoffs.
Yeah, that's right. And so he just want to kind of get a better picture of what's going on, wrap his own head, it sounds like, around what's going on here with the county.
Yeah, he said he doesn't, you know, suspect anything. You know, he said he's not looking for ghosts in the closet, as he put it. But he said that he thinks there are some questionable real estate leases. And there will be a meeting with the team from State Auditor Suzanne Bump's office to determine the scope of the audit on March 25th.
That's right. And the county commissioners are supportive of this. And it cost a little bit of a fee, I understand, but they're supportive of doing this.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure they think that the fee will be more than paid for by any savings that come out of the audit.
That's right. And I'm sure there's a lot of scrambling now to kind of figure out this budget crisis and avoid layoffs and the like.
Right, to do what they can.
Right, right. And in other news, we had sad news this week. We heard of a state trooper on the Mass Pike who died in a car accident. And also a deputy sheriff from Florida who has ties to the Cape who was also killed in a car accident.
And this story has just broken the hearts of people in Falmouth and in the law enforcement community. John Coatfila Jr., 30, was a native of Falmouth, and his father is a Massachusetts State Police Sergeant, and his brother is a Falmouth police officer. Law enforcement officials from the area left for Florida this week to bring his body home. John Coatfila was a Hillsborough County Deputy Sheriff. He was killed early Saturday by a wrong-way driver while returning from an accident investigation at Tampa General Hospital. And what's also especially heartbreaking about this is a woman who witnessed the crash said that she believes that that Coatfila possibly saved her life by actually getting between her and the wrong-way driver. She was flashing her lights at the car, and that wrong-way driver, who was also killed, was not stopping, and she said Coatfila got between the two of them. And he's remembered by former teachers and friends as a kind and caring individual who loved helping people and loved his job.
Right. And that, as you said, it is really a sad story. And those officers going down to Florida are kind of doing an important job here and kind of representing the region here, I imagine.
Yeah, they will be in honor guard and they will help with funeral arrangements. And there will be a wake Tuesday at the Chapman Cole and Gleason Funeral Home in Falmouth and a funeral mass on the next day at St. Patrick's Church on Main Street in Falmouth.
We just have about a minute left, not even. But the Times has been working on Sunshine Week all week. And that's an attempt to shine some light on public records and access to public records. And we've learned some interesting things.
Yeah, well, they were looking at different things such as how many, if committees are filing the minutes from their executive sessions, and also like who's attending different meetings and what their attendance records are like.
And we're out of time. I want to thank my guest, Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times, who is here in our studio. And our thanks to our other contributors, Ryan Bray of the Enterprise, Tim Wood of the Chronicle, Sarah Brown of the Gazette, Josh Balling of the Inquirer and Mirror, Jim DeRuda from the Standard Times, Ed Miller from the Banner, and Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you for listening. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup on the Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.